You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
What are you getting so crazy about? It's just music.
Producer Sam Phillips believed everybody had a song to sing. And lucky for us, some of those singers were named Howlin' Wolf, Elvis Presley, and Johnny Cash. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. We talked to Peter Guralnick about Sam Phillips, Sun Studios, and the birth of rock and roll. Plus, Adele's chart-busting new album, 25. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
This is Sound Opinions, and later on in the show, Jim, you and I are going to deal with the Godzilla of the pop charts. Adele is dominating the pop charts, 3.3 million sold in her first week. That is a record. She's not on any of the streaming services. If by chance you have not heard this record yet, we're going to let you know whether or not it's a sound purchase later on in the show.
But first, Greg, we have some music news.
That is Dance to the Music from Sly and the Family Stone, and that famous, ebullient voice of Cynthia Robinson, the trumpet player in Sly and the Family Stone. The reason we're playing that excerpt from that great song highlighting Cynthia is that Cynthia Robinson died at the age of 71 of cancer a few days ago. She was a guest on our show, Jim, in 2014, talking about her life in Sly and the Family Stone and what a life it was. She was childhood friends with Sylvester Stewart, as he was known in California back in the day. She herself was an aspiring musician. She gravitated from the flute to the clarinet to her final love, trumpet. She became one of the great trumpet players in the rock lexicon beginning in the 60s. She and Sly formed a band together, Sly and the Stoners, in the mid-60s, but it was Sly and the Family Stone that had the big hits. First album called A Whole New Thing. Things really exploded in 1967 with Dance to the Music, followed by hits like Everyday People, Stand, Hot Fun in the Summertime, Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again, just a string of great hits. And it's important to note that not only musically was this band groundbreaking in the way it mixed up funk and rock and soul, but, you know, the biracial co-ed nature of this group really spoke to the counterculture. I think in many ways, Sly and the Family Stone embody that vibe better than any band from that era.
Yeah.
And Cynthia Robinson was a key player in all of that greatness. I want to highlight one of the great examples of her playing on a Sly and the Family Stone record. In fact, she was highlighted on the very first track on the very first Sly and the Family Stone record. This is a track called Underdog from Sly and the Family Stone with Cynthia Robinson on Sound Opinions.
Hey, I do high speeds to expect to get a fair shake, but they won't let you forget that you're the underdog and you got to be twice as good.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if you're never right, they get uptight when you got too right, or you might start thinking too much. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I do high speeds when you know the real, but every other time, get out, you get a raw deal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Say, I'm there. Moving up too fast, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
If you ever love somebody of a different set, I bet the set didn't last you forget. And it just don't go like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I know how it feels for people to stop, turn around and stay.
Underdog by Sly and the Family Stone in tribute to Cynthia Robinson, dead at the age of 71. Check out our interview with her in the archives at soundopinions.org.
Hey, baby, jump over here when you do the ooby dooby. I just gotta be near ooby dooby.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that is Ooby Dooby by the great Roy Orbison, who was then with a group called the Teen Kings. It was produced in 1956 by Sam Phillips at Sun Studios in Memphis and released on his Sun Records label. Now, if Sam Phillips, Sun Studios, Sun Records are names that are new to you, Roy Orbison is just the beginning of a long list of artists who emerged out of that world in the 50s and 60s. In fact, many rock historians credit Sun with giving birth to what we now know as rock and roll. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Johnny Cash. Sun was home to black artists, white artists, all of whom were merging genres in ways that were unheard of at the time. Country, gospel, rhythm and blues, it was all coming together to form what we now know as rock and roll. We take it for granted now, Greg, but it was virgin territory at the time.
Yeah, so it's not surprising, Jim, that Peter Guralnick, of all the great writers in America, would want to take this topic on. I mean, Peter's written extensively about American music for decades, including a two-part biography on Elvis Presley, the biography Searching for Robert Johnson, and an acclaimed trilogy on American roots music. Now he's back with a comprehensive look at Sam Phillips called The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Peter, we're glad you could join us. Welcome to Sound Opinions.
Well, thanks very much.
So you've written a lot about Sam Phillips through your reporting on a number of artists who worked with him. Tell us about getting to know Sam.
Well, I met Sam in 79. I'd been trying to get together with him for almost 10 years at that point. Sam was doing no interviews, none whatsoever, because he saw it as a transgression against history. Mm. So finally, in 1979, I did get together with him, and it was probably, I would say that he was the most charismatic person I ever met, and it was one of the most inspiring meetings I've ever had.
I love the story I read somewhere, Peter, of how you got together with him in 79. That's when you wound up helping him recover from a flood in the studio, right?
Well, I mean, I met him out at his new radio studio, WLVS, which had just taken that name. Sam was totally dedicated to radio. When I arrived, Sam's son Knox came out to the curb and he said, you know, Peter, I'm afraid we're going to have to postpone the interview. And I think my face must have fallen through the floor, through the pavement. And Knox said, well, we've had a flood. The sprinkler system has let go and the whole studio is flooded, this brand new studio, Sam had designed, had built, you know, had been involved in every square inch of. Being of limited resourcefulness, but at least of a tiny bit, and said, isn't there something I could do to help? And then I spent the next 8 or 9 hours squeegeeing, carrying, you know, buckets of water, moving tapes, dusting off stuff. I mean, it was, you know, I was just a willing tool. But one of the things that was most interesting about it, and it was something that I realized, I think even at the time, was in watching Sam command this legion of people. I mean, I met everybody that day. I met his whole family. Everybody was there helping out. And Sam was just commanding their attention, their loyalty, and their actions in a way that was just galvanizing. And I realized, well, I'm never going to see Sam Phillips produce a record session. But here I'm seeing him produce a session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So from my point of view, that was, I mean, it wasn't that hard to make the most of it, but I wasn't prepared. As Solomon Burke once said to me, he says, bile can consume you. So stay away from the bile and go on the upbeat.
Yeah.
Yeah, you paint a very nuanced portrait of Sam Phillips in this book. And I think in some ways he was both a great leader and at the same time a very personal, private guy who was hard to get to know and hard to warm up to. What I'm fascinated by is the detail you bring to his early life and his relationship to African-American culture, leading to this sort of visionary approach as a producer. Talk about Uncle Silas a little bit and the role that he played in young Sam's life.
Well, Silas Payne was a blind black sharecropper whom the Phillips family took in when Sam was maybe 12 years old. And Sam always held him up as one of the three most influential people in his life. There was Silas Payne, there was his deaf-mute Aunt Emma, And there was the madam of the local house of ill repute who gave Sam a discount when he was 15, but who Sam said was just a model of humanity in terms of the way she treated the women, of the dignity that she gave them, and the way she ran her business. He said she was the best businesswoman he had ever, businessman he had ever met, business person he had ever met. But Silas Payne was somebody who Sam felt was so attuned to the universe, I guess. His blindness was scarcely a handicap, just as Sam's Aunt Emma's deafness and muteness were scarcely a handicap. And they made the most of the opportunities they were given. And Silas Payne just invested this 12-year-old Sam Phillips, this sickly kid, with a belief in himself, with a belief in the world's possibilities, with a belief in the freedom that came from the imagination, not from what you were given, that Sam took this as a lesson that he carried with him everywhere for the rest of his life. I mean, one of the key elements, Silas Payne would tell him stories about Africa, about the buckwheat trees and the like the lemonade springs or something. And as Sam said, you know, he never went to Africa. He was speaking about the imagination. He was speaking about the power of the imagination, about how your imagination could take you anywhere. And his greatest lesson of all, Sam said, was even if you're feeling bad, you're feeling good. I mean, that life offered you those opportunities, and you had better take them.
Ah, yeah.
The way you tell it, he was hearing this music coming from the cotton fields, you know, his father's farm in Alabama. Far more exciting than anything he was hearing, for example, in his own church services. He seemed to have an affinity for this kind of music from a very early age, which strikes me as unique, I think, in some ways, because you're raised in a time where civil rights were very much a questionable activity, could get you in trouble if you were a white guy in the South to honor black culture. But he seemed to love it and embrace it from an early age. How do you explain that?
Well, I think Sam always said that from the time he was just a small child, he was always different, and he prized his difference. He didn't want to be like everybody else. But I don't really know that he could explain it any more than you or I could explain it. He was working in the cotton fields as well. I mean, his father didn't own the farm. His father rented the farm. There were white tenant farmers, there were black tenant farmers. Sam worked in the fields and could give you quite a lecture on mules and plows and cotton rows and but he responded to the music he heard. It wasn't music, it was almost a life response that he heard coming from the black sharecroppers in particular.
In one mother hole, and a baby was born by the Virgin. Mary was wrapped in a holler, go home was laid in a holler, manger was born, Lordy, born in Bethlehem. Children going out with Cindy.
He also responded to the social inequity that he observed around him. And I know that this is true. I mean, you might think, well, this is somebody speaking in his 50s, 60s, 70s, long after the Civil Rights Revolution has been joined, and it's somebody who just is looking back and inventing it. But in speaking to members of his generation from the family, they all agreed that Sam had embraced this kind of sense of not embraced the injustice, embraced this reaction to the injustice that he saw around him and articulated his feelings in ways that were not particularly comfortable for some people, some other members of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And then he heard it coming from the black church, which was just a block and a half from the church that he and his family attended. And he would go down there every Sunday afternoon and just be caught up in music that was invested in so much belief and that carried you away in a manner that the music in his own church, even though he sang in the choir, he sang bass in a quartet, but he felt there was never that emotional release, and there was never that sense of the integrality of music, of how important, vital music was, in the same way that Uncle Silas's stories were vital.
We're talking to Peter Guralnick, author of the new book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock. And Peter, to get people a sense of the timeline, Sam Phillips spends the 40s as a radio announcer. In the early 50s, he starts a label, and he calls it Phillips, and it folds after one record, right?
Well, it does. He had no intention of starting a label. He got carried away with the enthusiasm of meeting Dewey Phillips, this very charismatic DJ on WHBQ, Red Hot and Blue. But he had his studio going for, I think, 8 or 9 months at that point.
Hmm. And so then 2 years later, he starts, he tries again. And this time he calls it Sun. And this time the results are really different.
He started the label because his vision originally, his vision of recording, it was, as he said, he wanted to record some of the great Negro talent of the South that had no opportunity to be recorded otherwise. And that's what he set up his studio for in 1950. He opened on January 2nd, 1950, with an open invitation, which was a difficult one to export. And eventually, Joe Hill Lewis, a blues singer named Joe Hill Lewis, a one-man band named Joe Hill Lewis, wandered into his studio. And he said, well, this is just what Memphis needs, a studio. And Joe Hill Lewis became Sam's ambassador to the black community. He would record the music, but he wouldn't, I don't know that he would use this term, but he wouldn't sully himself with selling the music. And he set up licensing deals, first with the Bahari Brothers and Modern, then with Leonard Chess at Chess Records.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by that Chess, Sun Studios, Sam Phillips kind of connection because, you know, some of the key artists, I mean, they're known as Chess artists, but they're known as Sun artists.
B.B. King's initial recordings were done by Sam Phillips for the Modern label, but he met Leonard Chess on, I think, something like March 2nd, 1951. They hit it off. Leonard Chess proposed a deal, and 3 days later, or 3 or 4 days later, he recorded Rocket 88 by Ike Turner and his Delta Cats.
Right.
And Rocket 88 really embodied a great deal of what he had originally envisioned for the music. I mean, it was upbeat. Because Sam was a rhythm man. He was very much into the rhythm, although he appreciated lots of other things, too. And Rocket 88, he saw as having this propulsive rhythm, having a contemporary theme. I mean, who could want anything more than to be driving a Rocket 88? And Jackie Brenston and the Delta Cats just gave it a kind of treatment that just carried a fairly ordinary song away, plus the fact that the guitarist's amp had fallen out of the trunk on the way up, busted a tube, and Sam just, they thought that would be the end of the session, and Sam just said, well, that gives it an original sound, because Sam prized difference above everything. And you can hear the buzz all the way through it. It's the kind of thing that if you took it to a major label, they would say, well, that's fine, but you're going to have to record that over. We got to get that buzz out of the out of the recording. But the song was a number one hit. Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston and the Delta Cats was a number one hit on the R&B charts. And amazingly enough, I mean, I only discovered this as I was working on the galleys, it sold over 100,000 copies, which is an astonishing figure for that time.
We'll continue talking to Peter Guralnick about Sam Phillips and the legendary Sun Records label in a minute here on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Later, Adele has sold millions of copies of her new release, but is it worth a buy it rating? Stay tuned.
In my rocket and don't be late, baby, we're pulling out about half past eight. Going round the corner and get a fifth, everybody in my car's gonna take a little nip. Move on out, oozing and cruising along. This morning, and I looked out the door. I can tell that old milk cow by the way she looks.
Holy fellas, that don't move me. Let's get real, real gone for a change.
Well, I woke up this morning, and I looked out the door. I
can tell an old milk cow can tell the way she low. Now if you saw my milk cow, he's a rockin' on home, home. I had no milk and butter since that cow's been gone.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis here with Greg Kot, and we've been talking with Peter Guralnick about his new book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. That voice, of course, belongs to Elvis Presley, a recording from December 8, 1954, called Milk Cow Blues Boogie. But it's fair to say the sound belonged to African-American musicians, specifically in that case to Kokomo Arnold. You know, Peter, I bring this up because a lot of has been made about Elvis and Sam appropriating black music, that notion that if he could find a white boy that could sing like these black artists, he could make millions. It, you know, according to some, it was a cold and calculated move, right? Mm-hmm. You've heard this. He didn't keep Elvis on the label for long. He sold the contract to RCA in 1955. But, Peter, if you could talk about Elvis's impact on Son and Sam.
Well, the simple thing was that he never lost. This is like talking about Aretha Franklin or Sam Cooke, and you say about them, they never left the church. And they didn't. It didn't matter what they sang. They never left the church. And Sam never left black music. That was what he believed in. That was the sound that he believed in. But having had this vision of not only Ike Turner's music, not only Rocket 88, but when he discovered Howlin' Wolf, and he said of Wolf, this is where the soul of man never dies. That was his response to the first time he heard Howlin' Wolf on the radio. He believed that Howlin' Wolf could reach millions, that there was no limit to the market that Howlin' Wolf could reach. And he said, in retrospect, Howlin' Wolf could have been as big as Elvis Presley if I could have continued to record him.
How many, oh yeah, if I've got to let you dog me around.
Now, this is one of the things that Sam says that I'm not prepared to fully endorse on a rational basis. On an emotional basis, I agree with him. There's no one greater than Howlin' Wolf. I dedicated Lost Highway to Sam and to Howlin' Wolf without fully realizing the connection. But how he intended to create this mass audience for Howlin' Wolf, I'm not sure. But the thing was, after a certain amount of time, after dedicating himself to working 18 to 20 hours a day recording this music and having hits of his own on the Sun label, which he finally formed, he came to realize that he couldn't present the music the way he wanted to and felt that he wasn't being treated the way that he would have liked to have been treated in business by the Beharis or by the Chess Brothers. I mean, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but it wasn't the way he wanted to do it. And having formed Sun Records and having had hits with Rufus Thomas, with Little Junior Parker, who was then Little Junior's Blue Flames, he came up against a ceiling that he had refused to recognize emotionally, that he believed he could overcome. And he came to realize that even with a big R&B hit, he couldn't reach more than 50 to 100,000 listeners at the most.
You ain't nothing but a bear cat, been scratching at my door. Ain't nothing but a bear cat, been scratching at my door. You can purr, pretty kitty, but I ain't gonna rub you no more. Oh, rub ya.
And that they were going to be predominantly black. And he truly believed, as he had from the time he was a child, just as he did when he first went to Beale Street at the age of 16 in 1939, he truly believed that this was music for everybody and that everybody should have the opportunity to hear it. And that, I think that was when he conceived of the idea that the only way to reach that larger audience was if he could find a white man with the Negro sound, and he said, much more important, the Negro feel. I mean, Negro being the term of the day and a term of respect. And once the music broke through, no doubt whatsoever, that the gates would just break wide open, that the divisions in music would break down, and then what would follow would be he wouldn't have called it, I mean, you couldn't call it rock and roll because he didn't know what it would be, but it would be the opportunity for great musicians like Big Joe Turner, Ray Charles, Chuck Berry, for them to reach a mainstream audience. And that's pretty much what happened.
The rock and roll business, I mean, that term hadn't really even been invented. Some people say when he recorded Rocket 88, that was the birthplace. But this idea of creating sort of a universal music that didn't have a genre attached to it was revolutionary, right? Sam's vision was that country, blues, R&B, race music, pop music, these were all just categories that divided people, and he seemed to be striving for the sound that was going to bring all those genres together and all those people together by extension.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. But it went beyond music. For Sam, this was a social, a racial, a musical, and a class revolution, because he felt there was nothing more important in Sam's life than his belief in democratic principles, democratic ideals, democratic vistas. And he believed, and I'll subscribe to this belief, that it was the manner in which not just music but people are consigned to categories. Was he just believed it was wrong. Everyone has something to say. It's really a Whitman-esque vision. I don't know that Sam read Whitman, but, you know, I Hear America Singing. And he truly believed that. He believed that to the depths of his soul.
Wait a minute. I don't forget.
Portland, Maine is just the same as sunny Tennessee. Hey, Portland, Maine is just the same as sunny Tennessee. Any old place that I hang my hat is home, sweet home to me.
You describe very well how he had these formative recording sessions with Howlin' Wolf, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash. These were not fully formed artists yet, or they didn't have a sense of what they sounded like or what they wanted to sound like. And it didn't seem like Sam knew that either. But the amount of time that he put into exploring, well, what's really inside of you, it was fascinating to me. Great deal of patience there and belief in not only himself, but in the artists that he brought into those studios. I mean, that was just a gut call on his part, right? That
it was total belief that they had something to say and that they simply had to be given the opportunity to say it. I mean, Marion Kiesker, who was his assistant, she always said it was astonishing how much patience Sam showed in a man not ordinarily given to patience. Somebody could tell him that they would be in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they might not show up until 3 in the morning, but Sam would still be there, and he wouldn't show the least bit of impatience. But I think that one of the aspects of his genius was the fact that he had sufficient belief that he was willing to sit there and to listen and to wait for whatever it was that was going to reveal itself to reveal itself. So that, I mean, when Elvis came in for his, it wasn't even a recording session that Elvis came in with Scotty and Bill. It was more like an audition. And Elvis sang ballad after ballad. And it wasn't that Sam didn't like the ballads, but he didn't feel that this was Elvis's mark. This was not the way Elvis was going to make his mark upon the world.
I love you because you understand, dear. Every single thing I try to do.
But the instant that Elvis started during a Coke break, and they're just about ready to give up on the session, they've been there for hours, and the instant that Elvis started just flailing away or frailing away on the guitar and playing That's All Right and the blues, there was nothing like nothing else that he had done to that point. Sam just immediately perked up, and he said, okay, what's that?
That's all right. That's all right. That's all right. I'm on my anyway do. Well, Mama, she done told me. Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you fooling with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway do.
You know, Peter, many of these Elvis recordings were huge hits. And it's interesting to think about that when you visit Sun Studios today, that room is tiny. It's so small, you know, but it looms so large in musical history. Tell us about the sound that Sam was going for and what was so special about that studio.
I think what's special about it, I mean, was Sam's dedication. He built it probably according to an Army engineering manual. I mean, Sam studied sound. His great boast, he would say, you know, I don't know about a lot of things, but the one thing I do know is about sound. And when he spoke about his childhood memories, he spoke with such precision about the sounds that he heard. You know, the sound of a hoe hitting the ground and then maybe hitting a rock, the sound of a whippoorwill, just the absolute silence, the wind going through the trees. And from Sam's point of view, sound was everything. He would far rather lose his sight, as Uncle Silas did, than lose his hearing, as his Aunt Emma did. And in that room, he built the room by hand according to the precepts of sound that he had, which I can't recapitulate. I mean, it's just all about, no right angles. And in recording, in doing his recordings, he believed most of all that microphone placement was key to the sound that you got across. Eventually, he invented this slapback, which was a kind of repeat echo, and that gave him an artificial way to create what he called a little bit of beautiful clutter, the way in which people hear music in real life as opposed to the sterile perfection of a recording studio. And you can hear, if you listen to alternate takes of various classic cuts, you can see how the sound changes from take one to take four or take five.
Well, as I come on over, baby, there's a whole lot of shaking going on. Yeah, as I come on over, baby, baby, you can't go wrong. I'm not faking a whole lot of shaking.
I mean, if you listen, for example, to the early takes of Whole Lot of Shaking, Jerry Lee has his cousin and soon-to-be father-in-law, J.W. Brown, on electric bass, and that bass is all over those first couple of takes. By the finished take, which might have been take four or take five, you can't hear the bass at all.
Yeah, I said shake, baby, shake. I said shake, baby, shake. I said shake it, baby, shake. I said shake, baby, shake. Come on over. Oh, a lot of shaking going on.
I guess I would think Sam was enough of a diplomat that he didn't banish J.W. Brown from the studio. I just think he took the microphone off of his, off of that bass.
He's running in there, moving mics around. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And nobody noticed the difference, right? Until the recording was done.
But I mean, with his slapback, I mean, just briefly, with this delayed or repeat echo that he created by having two tape recorders and having the second tape recorder, this Ampex 350. The sound from that coming back in just a little bit behind the live sound, and the musicians couldn't hear this. But with that, it's a very variable sound. And again, people speak about slapback, this echo effect, as being the key element of Sun. Well, if you listen to it, it's used extremely differently on different recordings. And Sam manipulated this by hand, by ear, and manipulated the length of time between the first sound and its delayed echo. And sometimes, for instance, with That's All Right by Elvis, there's no slapback at all. I think because he just saw that the purity of that sound and felt that slapback wasn't going to add anything to it. So, I mean, it's an aesthetic which I don't know that he ever is given full credit for.
You know, I think the takeaway for me, Peter, with Phillips' recording was simplify. Take stuff away rather than keep adding. And, you know,
you mean like taking J.W. Brown's bass away?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I mean, even like when you write about Great Balls of Fire, the Jerry Lewis track, it's basically drums, piano, you know, as you say, a tour de force of basically two instruments and a vocal.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill.
And, you know, part and parcel of that song is this incredible dialogue that Jerry Lee Lewis and Sam Phillips have in the studio while it's taking place, with at one point Jerry Lee declaring that, man, I got the devil in me, mm-hmm. while he's before he records his take. Explain what was going on there.
Basically, you have somebody in Jerry Lee Lewis, someone who has been, who is sincerely religious to this day, who is passionately religious, and Jerry Lee felt that it was profaning. Later on, he did this Jumpin' Jehoshaphat, a big blonde baby, and saying Jumpin' Jehoshaphat didn't profane anything. You listen to this dialogue between the two of them, and Jerry Lee gets into an almost preacher-like mode and is seriously, terribly disturbed.
H-E-L-L.
Big God, a mighty great balls of fire.
That's right.
It says, make merry with the joy of God
only.
But when it comes to worldly music, rock and roll,
rock it out,
anything like that, you have done brought yourself into the world, and you're in the world, and you hadn't come from out of the world, and you're still a sinner.
And then you hear Sam calming him down. He says, now Jerry, and he's basically saying, you know, are you telling me that music can't lead people towards the kind of feeling that religion represents? And you listen to this dialogue, and it's an astonishing piece of dialogue. It's astonishing evidence to the passion that went into the music and to the belief that propelled not just the artist, but Sam's belief in the music as embodying this spiritual essence, which Jerry Lee is denying absolutely. I mean, Jerry Lee is speaking from the tenets of the First Assembly of God Church, which wasn't that music didn't have a place in it, but this kind of music was not something which, there was no way that this was a pathway to heaven. And Sam is saying, this is a pathway to heaven. This is a manner of speaking of your belief. It's a manifestation of God.
Well, listen, Jerry, when you think that you can't do good, you're a rock and roll exponent.
You can do good, Mr. Phillips. Don't get me wrong.
Wait a minute.
You can have a kind heart.
I don't mean.
You can help people.
You can save souls.
No.
Yes.
We're talking to Peter Guralnick about his new book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, here on Sound Opinions. All right, Peter, I'm going to pose a question to you. You've got in front of you a 15 or 16-year-old kid who is voraciously curious about music. But to him or to her, 50s music is Happy Days on TV, mm-hmm. or the Broadway rendition of Million Dollar Quartet. What song would you play this kid to say, this is the sound?
I would say, listen to Moanin' at Midnight, the eeriness of it, the way in which it just has this otherworldly, unearthly kind of feel.
Helen Wolf.
But, you know, is that the essence of Sun Records? It wasn't on Sun Records, but is that the essence of Sam Phillips? It's the essence of everything that he was seeking to accomplish, everything that he heard, everything that propelled him into the recording studio.
Somebody knocking on my door.
Another way, a song like Jerry Lee's Whole Lot of Shaking Going On is so perfect and such an imperfect encapsulation of the joyousness that Sam felt was behind the musical moment. So, I mean, but basically what you would want to say to that 16-year-old or that 17-year-old is what Sam was saying all of his life, which is just be open to the experience. Don't slap a category on it. Don't slap some kind of label on it. You know, be open to what's behind it.
Yeah, here in the soul.
Mm-hmm. Here in the soul, Sure.
Peter, I think that's a great way to describe it. And, I would just add, from my personal taste, I might point people to something. I mean, you mentioned two tracks, particularly in the book, Elvis's version of Mystery Train, mm-hmm. and then, Johnny Cash with Folsom Prison Blues, which I think were two tracks that, again, I think Sam had an integral role in the way those songs ended up sounding and the universality that they ended up having.
With Mystery Train, in a sense, what's created with Mystery Train is that feeling of spontaneity that Sam felt was at the heart of all music. And we don't have any alternate takes of Mystery Train. And the way it sounds, you know, one would like to imagine there were no alternate takes. But you can hear Elvis laughing at the end. Just the song trails off in laughter. That, mm-hmm. And you feel like that's so much what Sam was aiming for. I think that would be another perfect representation of what Sam was trying to extract from the musician, from the artist, you know, that sense of joy, of spontaneity, of individuality. And it comes through so strongly, but it also, what enables it to come through is that sense of simplicity for which he was always striving. It's just cut back to its pure essence, and that's what you get.
Train, train.
The interesting thing with Folsom Prison was that when Johnny Cash first sang it, when he demoed it or whatever it was, an early take of it, his voice sounds so kind of fluty. It's almost like you had Marty Robbins come in to sing a love song. I mean, this is not to disparage Marty Robbins, who was a very soulful singer, but this, you don't think of Johnny Cash and Marty Robbins in the same breath. And he's singing in a higher register, and almost crooning this song, you know, I Shot a Man in Reno Just to See Him Die.
Hmm. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Sam didn't see the song to begin with, but I think John kept coming back to it, or at least it was a song that clearly meant something to him. And eventually Sam saw a universality in the song, that same sense of thwarted freedom, that sense of the need, the, you know, just the primacy of freedom and how important this was in everybody's life, and the idea of being locked up in jail as being, you know, the antithesis of this. And this was what he sold to Johnny Cash, I think, was just the idea that it had a broader appeal.
Yeah, I mean, who among us hasn't felt occasionally like shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die? And
well, you're right, it's a very common feeling.
Sure, Sam and Johnny made it feel like, well, yeah, we're like, we all have a little of that in us.
The interesting thing I think about Johnny Cash is that he, as much as anybody, I mean, people like Howlin' Wolf and Jerry Lee Lewis, their personas were themselves. But the thing with Johnny Cash was, I think he consciously fashioned a persona. And mm-hmm. you can hear that persona taking shape on Sun, and it grows even more on his Columbia recordings.
Well, if they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line, far from Folsom Prison. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
We've been talking to Peter Guralnick about Sam Phillips, the man who he says invented rock and roll. Peter, it's been a real treat. Thanks for joining us on Sound Opinions.
Well, thanks. I really enjoyed this.
People, you know what? My baby's left me, and she hadn't come back. And I'm gonna get on this old train and see can I find her.
So now we have a question for you listeners. Johnny Cash, Howlin' Wolf, Jerry Lee Lewis, what are your favorite Sun recordings? Have you visited that historic but tiny studio in Memphis? And what do you make of Sam Phillips' contributions to rock and roll? Give us a call to share your opinions on the air at 888-859-1800. When we come back, not the king, but the queen. We're going to review the latest from Adele. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
I'm going to ride all night tonight. Well, if I don't find my baby, I just ain't feeling right. She's been gone a long time. Wonder why don't she write to me? She should know that I'm lonely. Lonely as a man can be.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. That is a little bit of the song When We Were Young, the second single from Adele's third album, 25. Greg, you called her Godzilla earlier. You meant that in terms of commercial impact. No exaggeration to say she is the most significant artist commercially to arrive on the scene in 15 years. She sold almost 3.4 million copies of this record this week, and you have to go back to 2000 to find a record anywhere close. NSYNC sold 2.8 million back then of No Strings Attached. The difference was people still were buying CDs there. There was no download and there was no streaming. She emerged really out of nowhere in the UK when she was 18. Her debut album, 19, spawned that huge hit single, Chasing Pavements, really put her on the map. You know, album number two, she's firmly embraced already by the big money music industry. 21 is produced by Ryan Tedder and Rick Rubin, both super producers. 2012, she gives us a song for the James Bond film Skyfall, and then she disappears from the scene for a while. Stays home, is raising a child, suffering from writer's block by her own account. Then something kicks into gear, and she gives us 11 new tracks on 25. In addition to Ryan Tedder being back, we've got Max Martin, that Swedish super producer, Greg Kurstin, Danger Mouse, the Smeezingtons. It's a who's who of the top 10, really. Let's play a track from this record, and we'll get into our opinions when we come back. This is Million Years Ago by Adele from 25 on Sound Opinions.
I only wanted to have fun, learning to fly, learning to run. I let my heart decide the way when I was young. Deep down, I must have always known that this would be inevitable. To earn my stripes, I'd have to pay and bare my soul. But that was a million years ago.
Million Years Ago from the new Adele album, 25. That's my favorite song on the record, Jim, for a couple of reasons. I think it moves the bar a little bit for her in terms of her ambition. It suggests the vibe of a Brazilian bossa nova or some of the autumnal ballads that Sinatra was singing in the 50s. And I hadn't heard her sort of attempt this kind of a song before, and it's refreshing. She's got a great voice, obviously. It's the transparency in that voice, the power of that voice, the fact that she co-writes all her songs. I mean, her lyrics aren't exactly poetry, but I think people value the transparency in those lyrics. She seems to be singing about her life, obviously revisiting this relationship that was at the core of 21. She hasn't moved on a great deal emotionally since then.
No.
She still seems to be living in 21 land emotionally, but she's moved on in her life, and she's not really talking about that as much. But I think more significantly, she hasn't moved on musically. There were so many expectations attached to this record, given the huge sales of 21, that she probably couldn't possibly have hit a grand slam. Of course, the public is saying, we love this. But really, it's very conservative. And she changed the names of a lot of her producers. I mean, she expanded her producing team. She's added new producers like Tobias Gesso, who gave her that song When We Were Young, or Danger Mouse is also producing on this record, Bruno Mars. These are new names, but they really don't. It's almost like they're cowed by the whole, Adele, she's got to have a ballad to sing, and it's got to sound a certain way, and they're putting her back in that pocket. I think based on that first record and the singles off of 21, which I liked a lot, she's got a lot more in her. She can be challenged more. I'm let down by this record. For those two songs, I'm going to give it a try, but the rest of it is pretty boring, I think.
I think this record is a huge disappointment, probably the biggest disappointment of this century, Greg.
Wow.
It's a trash it record for me, absolutely. Look, I was a huge Adele fan with 19. The second album is the sound of Hollywood and big budgets and cash registers, and now this third album is even worse. The lyrics are facile, superficial, and insulting to your intelligence. I want every single piece of you. I want your heaven and your ocean, too. You look like a movie. You sound like a song. Don't pretend you don't want me. Our love ain't water under the bridge. I can't love you in the dark. I feel like we're oceans apart. Adele, the music is sterile, flaccid, wimpy, bland. The lyrics are even worse. You are better than this. You are so much better than this. This voice is extraordinary. Her personality and her charisma. She is a star, no doubt about it. I got to give 25 a trash it. I'm the only person in the universe, apparently, but I ain't buying it. However, we want to hear what you think. Why do you love Adele, or why do you agree with me? It's possible. Give us a call at 888-859-1800. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Well, next week, Jim, we've got some records you're definitely going to want to buy. At least we think you should. We've got our best albums of 2015.
Sound Opinions is produced by Robin Lynn, Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, and Libby Gormley.
Any messages while I was gone?
No. Oh, yes.
Important?
Well, rather. Miss Johnson phoned again today. I told her what you said to say, that you were not about.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
This is Tim from Aurora, Illinois. I was just listening and heard you guys talk about the new Kurt Cobain Montage of Heck album. And I totally agree that it's horrible that they would go through and take all of his information and put it out. But it's pretty interesting to hear what a true artist sounded like in his off time. Even that yodeling song that you guys played was pretty cool for being able to hear somebody just kind of goofing around. And it sounded to me like he was maybe just figuring out different ranges that his voice could hit, and maybe that could have been a future song. We go through CDs of old artists that we like the same way we listen to something about Lincoln's letters. We go through them even though they didn't want them to be made available, but it's of interest. I mean, all information is good information. So, thanks. Have a good night.
My name is Jan. I'm an older person, but Kurt Cobain did have some good music, and releasing this dredge of his pain is totally inappropriate. It's okay if his family wants to hear it, but it's very inappropriate. And it's sad that the widow is letting this go out. She, as an artist, should know better. Anyway, that's my comment. Thank you.
Lost my head there. Lost my head there. I don't wanna sit around, walk around today. I'd much rather levitate.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Chris from New York. Just calling, really enjoyed your Turkey Shoot episode. For me, it's probably got to be Kurt Vile's new record, Believe I'm Going Down. I couldn't help but be disappointed. I found that the songs that really appealed to me were the piano-driven songs, and, you know, Kurt Vile is one of the best guitarists around today. You know, his last album, Waking on a Pretty Days, was just so inventive and technically impressive and rocking, and this album lacks that. So that's my submission. Really love the show, and thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Hey, I was listening to your show about the Moog, and I have to say, after seeing Keith Emerson and Herbie Hancock, one that you didn't mention that was actually doing things at the same time, and maybe before Herbie, was the piece that came out in 72. It was by Doug Carr on Black Jazz label, and it's a song he did called Jihad, J-I-H-A-D. The song has one of the best Moog solos I had ever heard. Thank you.
This is Murray Lynn Anderson in Burnett, Texas. I very much enjoyed your program on the Moog synthesizer. I was kind of sorry that you did not spread out just a little bit to include the Simeon synthesizer and the group from the East Village called Silver Apples. My friends used to call that psychedelic sex music. It was some of the most awesome, throbbing, overwhelming music at the time that just pulsated and it ran through the room like nothing you've ever heard before. It was amazing. Thank you.
Spinning magnetic fluctuations, waves of waves, configurations, the dance between the poles of sound, and find my way to soul.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.